renowned artists. Tickets and information available at frequentflyers.org. This program is brought to you by the Boulder Jewish Community Center, providing specialty day camps with cultural, nutritional, and performing art themes. Preschool camps are also available. Registration and information available at boulderjcc.org.
Welcome to Metro Arts. I'm your host, Veronica Straitlingo. We've got a great show for you today. Coming up, the Catamounts are back with a fully original musical with book written by Jessica Austin and music written and recorded by Bonnie and Taylor Sims and performed by Bonnie and the Clydes. It's called The Last Apple Tree. And I had the opportunity to speak with director Amanda Berg Wilson about it. On Book Talk, host Diana Cordy speaks to Delia Owens, author of Where the Crawdads Sing. We'll also have another episode of After Image with Michael Casey and the Metro Arts Calendar. All that coming up, but first... Theater Company in Lafayette is presenting a regional premiere of Shorn by playwright Nora Douglas, starting tonight. Shorn is the story of the disputed and war-torn border area between nations. Three strangers find themselves together, and with humor and heartbreak, these three unreliable narrators reveal secrets as they try to survive in a world under siege. Earlier this week, I spoke with Nora Douglas and director Madge Montgomery about the show.
I just felt like it was this incredible character study. There are three characters, and they each have secrets that slowly they are able to release once they trust each other, and the relationships were very complex. It was really beautifully written, and, you know, Nora had really developed the piece beautifully, and I just felt like it would work so well in the Mary Miller Theater, which is such an intimate space.
Now, this piece explores three characters and their various stories about a war.
The situation is that this is a war of long standing, and two of the characters live out in the countryside. The way they're playing it here, it seems like it's an abandoned farmhouse that was once a nice house. So we don't know if it's her original house or how she got it, but then they come upon the third character, who has been ostracized from the village for fraternizing with the enemy. So she's been beaten up, her hair's been shorn. They're three characters who we would be easy to dismiss. Mm-hmm. They're not directly involved in the war, but they're victims of the war. So, you know, it started with the idea that boundaries in certain areas in Southern Europe and France and Germany, the boundaries shifted like every 10 or 20 years. So you would be a citizen of one country, and then you would be a city of another. And the decisions are made from on high, right? Drinking their schnapps and making these decisions for political reasons or military reasons without really considering how does that affect people who live in those areas. So the play takes place in a contested area. So Lena, the older woman, has had to change loyalties several times.
And so much of the joy for the audience is to watch the exterior slowly be taken off and removed as we delve deeper and deeper into these people's lives and secrets.
I think the characters are easy to judge at the beginning. And hopefully the judgment shifts to compassion by the end of the play. I mean, that's the hope. And I think these actors are bringing so much depth. And Madge, I mean, she's my dream director, and she knows how to just mine.
The play is really beautifully written, and Nora was Skyping in, so if we had a question, she would be right there, and we would be able to have a conversation about it. And sometimes she would even say that we had discovered something she didn't even realize was in the script.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
Well, you had mentioned, Nora, that kind of the setting took you by surprise, the interpretation of that. When a production kind of surprises you with new readings of your own work, can you describe what that feeling is like?
Well, for one thing, it gives me new confidence in the script. And what is so pleasing to me is that it tells me that this play works in different ways. I think this, you know, partly having a longer rehearsal period, but I think also these particular actors so in tune. I'm thrilled to see that a play can work in different ways, different choices. My job is kind of done, so I've been honing in trying to help with props so I can stay. So
just finding any reason to stick around.
Yeah, exactly. I'll do that. But no, I'm so thrilled that somebody else can take it and take it in a direction that I hadn't anticipated and just blow me away.
You know, it is, parts of it are very moving and poignant, but there's also humor. And I think we've worked really hard so we didn't fall into sort of this unrelenting seriousness because living and surviving in a war is very serious. We wanted to make that, you know, do that with integrity, but also people look for joy no matter what the situation is. And in some ways, finding those pieces were the places where you could legitimately lighten things and keep the story going. That was really a satisfying process to find that because it's really there. You could overlook it if you weren't really looking closely at the script.
And I think that's one of Madge's real talents is being able to touch those highs and lows. And she's really good at finding the, and supporting the humor.
Theater Company of Lafayette throughout the years has worked very, very hard to produce high quality works by contemporary playwrights. This is can be a creative risk for theater companies. Why is it so vitally important for Theater Company Lafayette? Why do you keep doing this work? And what does it bring to the Boulder community?
Well, I think Theater Company of Lafayette wants to stand out by doing things that other theaters maybe don't choose to do, that we want to offer something that's a little unusual for our audiences. And Lafayette has evolved into a community that really values the arts and values innovation, and we really want to be in touch with that community. We found, for the most part, that audiences are willing to take a chance and be adventurous. And I think sometimes people come and they don't know what to expect, and so they're seeing something that, you know, nobody else has seen, they haven't read about, and they get to be really surprised. And I think it just keeps us on our toes, too. And having an opportunity to have a playwright come and be involved in the process has been really exciting for all the theater artists, the designers, and most particularly the actors have really enjoyed that process to really understand how a script is brought to life. I think it's been really, really fun. And I think it helps. It's sort of part of our identity now that we do new work. I love it.
Theater Company of Lafayette premieres Shorn by Nora Douglas. It starts this weekend. Shows are Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2.
Correct.
For more information, where can people go?
www.tclstage.org.
Madge Montgomery, Nora Douglas, thank you both for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Veronica.
Shorn runs weekends now through August 17th at the Mary Miller Theater in Lafayette. More information is available at tclstage.org. This is Metro Arts on KGNU. The Catamounts are proud to present a musical journey through Westminster's history with their latest collaborative work, The Last Apple Tree. Using a book written by local playwright Jessica Austin and original music written by Bonnie and Taylor Sims and performed by Bonnie and the Clydes, The Last Apple Tree is an original, site-specific musical celebrating the legacy of one farm homestead in Westminster, Colorado. With me to talk about it is director Amanda Berg-Wilson. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've put together an incredible group of talent to make this work. Can you tell us a bit about the inception of The Last Apple Tree?
A gentleman by the name of Rich Newman from the city of Westminster sent me an email last fall and said that he had received a grant and he wanted to do an outdoor theater project. His original collaborator had fallen through, but he had heard through the grapevine that the Catamounts know how to do outdoor work, which is true, of course. Our feed series, we've done several incarnations of it outdoors. And then, of course, last year we did this crazy outdoor immersive theater piece on 3 acres of Boulder open space called Rausch. So I was really intrigued by the opportunity to collaborate with a city entity because we're fairly scrappy and DIY at the Catamounts. So the idea of getting to collaborate with a larger organization was really appealing. So Rich took me on a tour of quite a few of Westminster's open spaces. And when he brought me to Semper Farm, he told me about this prize-winning apple tree on the property and pointed it out to me and explained to me that it was the last of the prize-winning apple trees from when Westminster was all orchards and not houses and malls and the things that it is today. And there was something about that metaphor of the last apple tree, of this remnant of an earlier time, that was incredibly poetic and potent to me. So that's where we started, was this image of the last apple tree. And then Jess and Bonnie and Taylor Sims went out there and we just started digging into the history of this farm. And it's really rich and interesting and suggested all kinds of wonderful theatrical vignettes to us.
What is your favorite part about working with immersive outdoor theater?
Well, you know, I think it's just this really interesting time when we live in a very technological digital age. And in the midst of it, I think that theater is really making its case for how its three-dimensionality is more indelible and important than ever. And so here you are with this outdoor space, which is easy to pass by and not register. And I think that what we're doing with The Last Apple Tree is really activating this space and making it come alive in this way that you otherwise, you know, reading a placard by the old homestead house doesn't necessarily bring alive. And so just the experience of being in this beautiful place. The show starts at 6:30, and I will tell you that 6:30 to 8 on this farm is magical. The way that the light starts to shift as the sun sets in the west, the way that everything sort of glows and is green. And then when ignited with these songs and these, you know, we've taken historical characters and kind of put our own interpretation of their relationship with the farm. So it really, it's an argument for how theater just make things come alive.
What's your favorite moment?
Oh, gosh. Well, there is, I actually like could almost not talk about it without crying. There's a moment in which we've, Linda Allison was the woman who inherited the farm from her father, who inherited it from his father, and she left it to the city of Westminster so that it would not be developed and it would be available to the larger public. And there's a moment that Jess has written between Steve Allison, Linda's father, and a young Linda Allison, in which he just basically says, your legacy is in this farm, and so take care of it. And the idea that the way that she took care of it was not just to take care of it and then pass it along to her progeny, but to pass it along to this larger thing, just for me is so moving. The idea that there are folks who take a very valuable thing that they own and make it available in perpetuity to other people, I just find amazing. And so I think that that's my favorite. The piece is just really an argument for open space and for staying connected to parts of the earth that carry history.
The Catamounts presents The Last Apple Tree next weekend. It runs Thursday through Sunday, August 8th through the 11th. More information and tickets are available at
cityofwestminster.us.
We're speaking with Amanda Berg-Wilson. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
And you're listening to Metro Arts. Up next, the latest episode of After Image with Michael Casey. Michael Casey, lots to talk about coming up in film this week. But first, the Fast and Furious, the latest release. Tell us a bit about it.
Yes, Fast and Furious 8.5, or as the actual title is, it's Fast and Furious Presents : Hobbs and Shaw. And for those of you keeping track at home, that is 2 ampersands and 1 colon per movie title. And this movie is that in a nutshell. This has everything. It is bananas. Basic storyline is the world's in jeopardy. There is a new deadly virus out there. It's called the snowflake, and it melts you from the inside out with 100% kill rate. So take that for what it's worth. The bad guy is played by Idris Elba, and he wants it because he wants to purify the world. But the only two to shop it is Hobbs and Shaw. Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Jason Statham, both who appeared in previous Fast and Furious films. This is the first film that does not have Vin Diesel or Paul Walker or Chris Ludacris or whatever in the movies. And it actually does a really good job of wrestling the franchise away from the key players and putting this, like, whether it's a spinoff or another direction, it works out really well. Introduced in this movie is Hattie, played by Vanessa Kirby. She is an MI6 agent. She can hold her own. And she's actually the one who instigates this by stealing the Doomsday device. But she doesn't actually deactivate it. She just kind of delays it. So they have 30 hours to deactivate it, or she'll be the first victim, and then hundreds of millions, maybe billions, will die. This is the fourth time the world's been in jeopardy in these Fast and Furious movies. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's a lot of fun. This movie is completely over the top. Hobbs and Shaw are kind of like DBZ Super Saiyans come to life. They can do just about anything, but the fight scenes are really good. This movie is directed by Devin Leitch, who directed the first John Wick, so you get this great action kind of sequence. There's a lot of it that's very Jackie Chan-esque. You get the full frame bodies kind of in motion when they're in an environment. Anything is on the table. There's a lot of comedy to it. There's a lot of absurdity to it. At one point, the Rock tries to pull a military helicopter out of the sky using a chain and a hook. It all really works, and it is fast and furious. This movie is 2.5 hours long, and it really doesn't drag. And there it's not all action sequences and chases. There's a lot of downtime where the two of them get to snipe at each other. And they're really kind of the best parts of the movie. They have this really great comedic timing. Jason Statham plays the guy that you just love to hate, and The Rock plays the guy that you love to love. So it works out really well. That is in wide release. It'll be playing everywhere for, I'm sure, the next month. But it's good.
Well, on the complete other end of the spectrum is a new documentary out about Toni Morrison.
Yes. Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, is kind of an unstandard approach to the documentary subject. If you've seen these movies before, you kind of know how they progress. There is the subject that is being interviewed. There are the Greek chorus behind them, their friends, their contemporaries, their historians. They provide the context of the said person's life. And you get all of this archival footage that gives you an idea of who they're talking about. And in this case, it's Toni Morrison, the Pulitzer Prize winning and Nobel Prize winning author. And she's fantastic. But why this movie works is because it is made with this kind of care and this love for the subject. Instead of having Toni Morrison be interviewed by someone else and where she's talking off camera to an unseen interviewer, she's actually sitting in the middle of the frame. She's talking to us. She's telling her life story. And it's not just how the books were written or what the books are about, but her schooling in the 50s and the 60s, her job teaching creative writing at the University of Southern Texas and at Howard University, her time as an editor at Random House, where she championed Black and female authors and she tried to bring a different voice to it, and then all the while raising two sons on her own. But in addition to her own voice, we get all of these other characters that give the context, that give kind of her backstory. We get Oprah Winfrey, we get Hilton Ells, we get Walter Mosley, Sonia Sanchez, Robert Gottlieb, her editor, David Carisacco, who gives probably the best reading of Morrison's work, which is, he calls her the Emancipation Proclamation of the English Language. It is kind of this lionization of Morrison, and if she was absent from the film, I think it would be a little over the top. It would be kind of this distancing effect between you and the work. But the more she's there, the more she really brings this personality, and that's what is so spectacular about her work. That is Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, that will be playing August 7th through the 9th at the Dairy Arts Center in Boulder.
So also coming up is the final screening this year of the Chautauqua Summer Silent series.
Yeah, this year it's going to close out with a big one. This is Seventh Heaven from 1972. This is one of Frank Borzage's best. It's a melodramatic film, but it works really well. It will be accompanied by the Monte Alto Picture Orchestra. You will not believe what's in this movie and the time it was made when you see it. It's a delight. Just go. That is Wednesday, August 7th. Doors open at 7, showtime 7:30.
Michael Casey, for more information about you and your work and your reviews, where can people go?
Go to michaeljcinema.com, boulderweekly.com, and every Thursday, pick up the hardcover paper. It is free around Boulder County, free and independent since 1993.
After Image is a regular feature right here on Metro Arts. Up next is Book Talk.
This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is former African wildlife researcher and nature writer Delia Owens. Her debut novel is Where the Crawdads Sing. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you for having me.
You studied wildlife in Africa for more than 23 years. Part of the time you were with a fellow researcher, but much of it, you said, was in extreme or partial isolation, which is leading up to a discussion of your book and your character. But did that suit you?
When I was growing up, I was a very social person. I grew up in South Georgia. I had a lot of friends, went to parties. And then my dream was to go to Africa and study wildlife in remote places. And I did that. And My former husband and I were very remote. At one stage, we were the only two people in an area the size of Ireland. Then, and we studied lions and brown hyenas there. When we moved up after many years and studied elephants in Luangwa Valley, I actually moved out to an even more remote location and lived there by myself. And so, yes, for many years, I was very remote and isolated. And I found out that it did affect me.
Good or bad?
Both? At the time, I needed to be isolated, and I loved it. I mean, I was out there with the baboons would come through my camp. I could walk from the camp and observe the elephants. I absolutely loved it. But when I came back to live in this country, I realized that I was no longer comfortable being in a group. I love being one-on-one or two or three people together. I love being with my friends. But if I get in a group of 10, 12 people, I just feel uncomfortable. It seems like a lot of confusion. It bothers me. I don't like being there. I just stay on my own. I mean, I live now outside of town. And the town I live near is 350 people, and I live 20 miles out, and I go to town once a week. So most of the time, I'm on my own still.
But that seems like a good thing for you.
It works. I'm starting to feel lonely. I am. And I feel like now it's harder to work my way back into where I was socially because I've been isolated for so long, but I feel like I want to. So I'm working on that. I'm actually working on it.
You must love this book tour.
I am. I'm in a different town almost every day. I meet great people like you, and I have fun with it. But then I have to go to a bookstore and give a talk to, you know, people, and I feel very shy and nervous. But people are so great. You know, they don't mind. They understand. It's not that big of a problem.
Well, back when you were in Africa and doing this research, what was a typical day like?
That's hard to say. In the Kalahari, it would be 110, 120 degrees during the day. So we worked at night. We would follow the lions and brown hyenas, the main research subjects, and they were active at night because of the heat. So we would go late afternoon, find a pride of lions, and wait for them to get up to hunt. Sometimes we'd sit with them for 2-3 hours in the heat. It would be so hot that the lions would move up and sleep in the shade of our truck, so they'd be right outside of our truck. Then when they finally were ready to hunt, we would follow them through the night with using a spotlight to follow them and observe their behavior through the night. And then in the daytime, we would try to sleep. But it would be very hot, so we would put water on our T-shirts and all of our clothes to lie on cots to try to stay cool with the water. And of course, that was the only water for many square miles. So the bees would come and land on our wet towels for the moisture. And these were the African killer bees. So during the day, we had African killer bees. And at night, we were following lions. But it was a wonderful life. I can't tell you how many exciting times we had with the lions coming into camp, romping around, tearing down our mess tent. It was just many, many years of great adventures.
Sounds like it. Back to your book. Who is Kaya and where does she live?
Kaya is the book starts with Kaya as a 6-year-old girl. She was raised in the wild coastal marsh of North Carolina. And the first opening scene, I'm not giving anything away because it's the first scene, she watches her mother walking away.
Yeah, and that chapter called Ma.
Ma. She watches Ma walk down the lane, and she keeps thinking her mother's going to come back. But eventually, all of her family members walk down that lane and don't come back. And by that time, she's 10 years old. And so she does have some skills by then, and she's tough. Because she's been raised in the marsh. She knows how to fish. She knows how to collect mussels and so forth. But still, she's alone at 10 years old. And the story is Kaya's story about how she learns from the wild to survive and her efforts to reach out to people and to be accepted. It's about her isolation and how it affects her.
What would you say her story is about?
Her story is about learning.
I mean, it's a mystery.
It's the novel is a mystery, an intent. Yes, the novel is a mystery, an intense love story, and a courtroom drama is what it is. That's what it is on the surface. Underneath, it's an exploration of the raw core of human nature. It really, what I wanted to do, I've studied sociobiology. I wanted to write a mystery that didn't just ask who done it, but ask why that person behaved as they did. The story goes deep into people's characters and what they are going through and how their lives, I parallel several characters' lives with the natural history of some of the animals in the marsh. The wild coastal marsh in this story is not just background. It's almost a story. The wild coastal marsh is not.
It's a character.
Yes, it's a character. And it is also a lot of the clues to the mystery are brushed into the natural history of the species that live in the marsh. And so I might be describing a heron, I might be describing lightning bugs, but some of their natural history gives clues to why certain people are behaving the way they do. Because we still have ancient genes in us that dictate a lot of our behavior. It really does explain a lot about why we behave the way we do. And that's what this novel explores.
Is this area on the North Carolina coastline still as wild as it was when she lived there?
No, it's not. They have protected some of it. In fact, they've done a pretty good job of protecting a lot of the marsh, but the area surrounding, like the Outer Banks and some of those areas of North Carolina, are developed now.
You dedicated your book to three of your girlfriends.
I dedicated my book to my troop, Margaret, Amanda, and Barbara. We've been friends since we were in second grade. And we were growing up, well, in Thomasville, where I grew up, you had a constellation of mothers. Everybody's mother was everybody else's mother. I mean, and grandmothers. And one of two of the ladies, Margaret and Amanda, are twins. And their grandmother's name was Danny. She taught us a toast. Here's told ya. If I never seed ya, I never knowed ya. And so we would sit down with our little shot glasses full of Coca-Cola and toast each other 20 times. And to this day, when we get together, we no longer drink Coca-Cola in our shot glasses, but we toast each other with that toast. And that is written in the book as the dedication.
Where would I have to go to hear a crawdad sing?
Well, I learned from a book that crawdads don't really sing. But the important thing is, I learned from my mother that if you go deep enough in the wilderness, you'll hear them anyway. That expression came from my mother. When I was young, she would encourage me to go as deep into the woods as I could. And she'd say, go way out yonder where the crawdads sing, because she wanted me to experience nature. She was a real outdoor girl, even though she was a real Southern belle as well. But she's the one who encouraged me to go into the wild and camp, and we experienced a lot of that together, my mother and I. And that expression came from her, and it means a lot to me. And I think about her now, and sometimes when I get way out in the wilderness, I'll think, sure enough, I'm going to hear the crawdads sing.
Well, thank you. My guest is Delia Owens, author of Where the Crawdads Sing, published by Putnam. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.
Thank you, Diana.
You're welcome.
And you can catch Book Talk right here on Metro Arts. This is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Up next, the Metro Arts Calendar. This is the Metro Arts Calendar for the weekend of August 2nd. For more information on these and other events, or to post your own, please go to kgnu.org. Frequent Flyers presents the Aerial Dance Festival all this weekend at the Dairy Arts Center in Boulder. Catch new and innovative aerial performances from around the globe with a mix of trapeze, fabric, invented apparatus, rope, and more. Tonight is also First Friday on both the Santa Fe Arts District and the Nobo North Boulder Arts District. There are lots of exhibition openings, gallery tours, workshops, and more. Get out there and enjoy some art. For more information on these and other events, or to post your own, please go to kgnu.org. That does it for Metro Arts. Thanks so much for listening. This is KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Stay tuned for the Laura Flanders Show.
Support comes from the Center for Transformative Movement, reminding you that dance is not just something you do at parties, and providing community-based programs like Dance with a Doc on the last Saturday of the month, where you can discuss the benefits of free-form movement with health professionals. More information can be found at cftmove.org. That's cftmove.org.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU listener member, and by Save Home Heat Company, providing professional service and installation of heating, cooling, plumbing, and electrical systems, proudly serving the Boulder, Denver area for over 35 years. More information at savehomeheat.com.
You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. Stay tuned for the Laura Flanders Show.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is the Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real-life models of shifting power from the few to the many in the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, and governance.
The Pentagon syndrome. There's something sick about U.S. military spending. It's certainly not keeping anyone safe. This week, why we the public spend billions on bad technology and what happens to service people who speak up. Then, a peace economy. What might that look like? I'll talk to Jody Evans of Code Pink. It's all coming up on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. So what gives? 3 decades ago, revelations that the U.S. military was paying $640 for an aircraft toilet seat ignited wild media coverage and public outrage. But to no avail. Last year, the Air Force paid $10,000 for a toilet seat cover. Just the cover. Our spiraling military budgets don't necessarily make for better defense, but they do keep growing. Meanwhile, the system is putting service people's lives at risk more often than not. Here to discuss how this mad military money machine or Pentagon virus works, I have Pam Campos-Palma, a political strategist and veteran of more than a decade in the U.S. Air Force, Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who directs the New Internationalism Project there, and joining us from Ireland via Skype, my uncle, Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and the author of the article that sparked this conversation, The Military Industrial Virus. It's a piece you will really want to check out. Andrew, let me start with you. Your story drew on decades of your research. Were you surprised by the kind of drop-off in public outrage about Pentagon spending?
Well, a little, although, you know, things have gone downhill in so many areas so much that I suppose I'm inured to disappointment and depression. Yes, I mean, I thought the $10,000, the example you just cited, the $10,000 toilet seat cover. I mean, the $640, that was like, you got the whole toilet seat for that. Now they rip you off just for the cover. It did surprise me a bit. I really thought that one would have legs.
Phyllis, you work on the Hill as part of your work with the Institute for Policy Studies. You talk to both Democrats and Republicans. You bring these sorts of subjects to their attention. Is Andrew right? And am I right? Is there a kind of inurement that's happened, if that's a word?
I think that what's much more important than the immediate response of people on the Hill of any party is what happens in social movements. I think that's how we change things. And it is difficult. I mean, I think ironically, the $10,000 toilet seat is the least of it. The real issue is that 54 cents out of every discretionary federal dollar goes right to the military. And that's why there's not enough money in our budget when we are the richest country that ever existed in the world, in the history of the world. That's why there isn't money available at all times for education and healthcare and jobs and infrastructure and green technology and all these things. It's because of the diversion to the military.
Do we even know how much we're spending on the military? Let me just bring Pam in on this. Do we actually know what the numbers are?
So As you mentioned, I served after 9/11. I served in a time where I think increasingly there's this big elephant in the room where we call ourselves the most powerful military in the world, and yet we don't see ourselves being functional. We even see ourselves as an organization that's just lacking in transparency and that is run like a corporation. I think one of the interesting parts of the article was this mention of whistle.